Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half hour segment, we're going to continue with our discussion of German corporate acquisitions in America. We've been speaking about, first of all, the Bertelsmann Corporation, one of the German core corporations, which now owns Random House Incorporated, and with its other American purchases, is now the largest English-language publisher in the world, with sales volume roughly twice of any other American English-language publishing competitor. We also took a look at the Von Holtzbrinck Publishing Group, which is another major force in American publishing. And in addition to the discussion of the ostensibly mild Nazi affiliations of George von Holtzbrinck, the founder of the company, we saw the fact that, in fact, George von Holtzbrinck was an enthusiastic Nazi, having joined a Nazi youth group in 1931, 2 years before Hitler came to power. He then was an enthusiastic collaborator of the Third Reich, and after World War II, appointed many ex-Nazis, including one notorious SS man, to key positions in his publishing empire. And now, along with the Bertelsmann Group, the von Holtzbrinck publisher is another dominant force in American English language publishing. We then took a look at the Daimler-Benz company's purchase of the Chrysler Corporation, a key acquisition, although Chrysler, in terms of sales volume, is relatively small relative to Ford and GM. Its profits, its price-earnings ratio is very, very high, and that makes it an excellent acquisition from a business standpoint for Daimler-Benz. I would point out, though, that with the coming of the euro, it's altogether likely that the dollar will become much stronger if the euro is a weak currency, and many feel it will be, and that may very well lead to the firing of American workers and the closing of American plants, because American manufactured exports will be too prohibitively expensive for people in other countries to buy. We also took a look at the fact that a merger of this type, which is anti-competitive, would have been blocked by the European Union. This gives the German-dominated European Monetary Union a significant advantage in terms of acquiring corporate properties in the United States. The last item we looked at was the influence of such American auto giants as Henry Ford, of course, the Ford Motor Company, and Charles Baudot of General Motors, in pioneering production techniques that were later adopted by German auto manufacturers, including Daimler-Benz. I would note in this context, as illustrated in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program, Henry Ford was an enthusiastic backer of Adolf Hitler, his earliest and most prominent financial supporter, and portions of Henry Ford's The International Jew, a book that was a compilation of Henry Ford's anti-Semitic newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, were, according to many scholars, incorporated directly into Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography and political manifesto. Charles Baudot was enthusiastically pro-Hitler and was one of the backers of the 1934 coup attempt to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt. He pioneered the brutal speed-up technique in which workers were forced to work so fast that many of them died in the process. And during the Great Depression, many of the workers put up with this because they were fearful of losing their jobs. We're going to continue to take a look at Daimler-Benz as a corporate entity and its history, which is inextricably linked with the history of fascism and the Third Reich in particular. We're going to go back to a book that we excerpted in our last half-hour segment. That book is entitled Daimler-Benz in the Third Reich. It's authored by Neil Greger, G-R-E-G-O-R, who is described on the inside jacket as a lecturer in history at Southampton University. That is that, of course, in England. This study won the Frankel Prize for Contemporary History in 1996. And the basic thesis of this book could be summed up by reading the inside flap, and I'm going to do just that. Daimler-Benz in the Third Reich is described by Neil Greger. This is a study of the experience of one of Germany's most important armaments manufacturers and automotive companies during the period of the Third Reich. It is based on a substantial body of new material, including previously unreleased archives at Mercedes-Benz AG, much of which has only recently become available since the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. It makes a major contribution to the controversial debate on the relationship between big business and the Nazis. Greger first traces the history of the Daimler-Benz company from its formation in 1926 through the crisis years of the Depression, and examines how the opportunities afforded by Nazi rearmament in the 1930s led to rapid expansion and a surge in its profits. His main focus, however, is on the war itself. Here, he demonstrates that the company succeeded in exploiting the demands of the war economy, while at the same time situating its operations most advantageously for the resumption of commercial activity in peacetime. This last couple of sentences again, because this is critical in understanding the German and Nazi understanding of the continuity between war and peace. That continuity was perhaps first formalized by von Clausewitz, the Prussian military theoretician, but one of the successes of post-war Germany was that even while waging war, they saw to it that their military and economic policy were aimed at producing a strong post-war recovery, including not only corporate takeovers of other European corporations, but the decimation of population so that they couldn't produce soldiers and workers, and also the looting of liquid capital assets all over Europe to be subsequently rechanneled into the German economy through the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of an underground Third Reich. Returning once again to the jacket flap of Daimler-Benz in the Third Reich by Neil Greger, speaking of the book, here he demonstrates that the company succeeded in exploiting the demands of the war economy while at the same time situating its operations most advantageously for the resumption of commercial activity in peacetime. Indeed, a central argument of the book is that, despite Allied bombing, Daimler-Benz AG emerged from the war in good shape and with a clear operating strategy, its inventory largely intact, and its core production lines geared for the peacetime market. The book reveals that its self-interest and self-preservation, the book reveals that self-interest and self-preservation were the prime motives behind the company's acquiescence in the brutal exploitation of forced labor of civilians, prisoners of war, Jews, and other victims of the concentration camps. Greger argues that the ability of the company to protect its interests during the war and manage the transition to peace was predicated upon collusion in the racial barbarism of the Nazi regime, and that company self-interest actively intensified the suffering of the Reich's victims. Indeed, it's important to understand the continuity between Third Reich wartime policy and both its pre- and post-war policies. The aforementioned Prussian military theoretician von Clausewitz noted that, quote, "War is the continuation of politics by other means." The reverse is also true. Politics is the continuation of war by other means, and that is a principle that has been very, very effectively understood by the Germans, and they have put it to good use in the post-war world. More about the continuity between the Daimler-Benz of the Third Reich period and the contemporary Daimler-Benz that now owns Chrysler. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, who researched the following from The Guardian. The Guardian is a British publication, and this is from The Guardian's issue of Wednesday, March 13th of 1996. This is a story of one of the dominant industrialists in the Third Reich, a man named Friedrich Flick, last name F-L-I-C-K, who was a major war criminal and who was convicted of war crimes, although he received a wrist slap, and ultimately Friedrich Flick was able to achieve profound influence in the post-war world, despite the fact that some 40,000 slave laborers were worked to death in his factories, just as many slave laborers were worked to death in the Daimler-Benz factories, as Neil Greger testifies in the book we just dealt with. And ultimately, Friedrich Flick became a principal capital, became the dominant capital interest in Daimler-Benz. He traded, as we will see, his exhausted mines and factories for a controlling interest in Daimler-Benz, and he then proceeded to staff the board of directors of Daimler-Benz with enthusiastic comrades from the Nazi period, basically ideological Nazis. Once again, this article from the British Guardian, Wednesday, March 13th of 1996, it's called Shame Behind the Name, subtitled, "There's more than a title involved in the controversy over the Flick endowment to Balliol College, Oxford. There's the matter of where the family fortune really came from. Tom Bauer investigates." By the way, Tom Bauer, the author of a couple of good books about the post-war resolution of Third Reich interests and personnel, one of them called The Pledge Betrayed, about the failure of denazification in Germany. The other book is called The Paperclip Conspiracy, about the importation of Nazi scientists and defense specialists into the U.S. defense industry at the end of World War II. And of Friedrich Flick's World War II career, we read, skipping down, "The industrialist Friedrich Flick, who died in 1972 at age 89, was directly associated with the enslavement and murder of tens of thousands of Jews and other nationalities in the course of accumulating the fortune that Muck, that's his son, eventually inherited and is now enjoying. Overwhelming documentary evidence of grandfather Friedrich's unswerving loyalty to Hitler and his profitable conspiracy with murderers was discovered. beginning again, overwhelming documentary evidence of Grandfather Friedrich's unswerving loyalty to Hitler and his profitable conspiracy with murders was discovered after 1945 by American war crimes investigators. In 1947, Frieck was convicted as a war criminal at Nuremberg for his use of slave labor and sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. After his premature release in 1951, he sought to sanitize his past and remove the family's brown stain. By the time of his death, Friedrich, who had never lost respectability among his German peers, owned nearly 50% of Daimler-Benz, worth more than $1 billion. One more time, because this is the dominant family in Daimler-Benz. By the time of his death, that in 1972, Friedrich, who had never lost respectability among his German peers, owned nearly 50% of Daimler-Benz, worth more than $1 billion. Much of that fortune passed to his two grandsons, and ever since the mid-80s, they have been welcomed as residents in London by estate agents and other traders. And skipping down, more about Flieck. Flieck eagerly volunteered to fund Hitler's 1933 election campaign and paid thereafter regular amounts to Heinrich Himmler's private account. In return, he rapidly expanded his empire by purchasing factories at peppercorn prices confiscated from Germany's Jews and later those seized in neighboring countries occupied by the Nazis. Contrary to the mythology perpetrated by self-interested revisionists, no one forced Flieck to assume ownership of those profitable businesses, and significantly, hundreds of other German industrialists rejected those opportunities. As proof of his loyalty, Flieck volunteered to accompany Himmler in 1937 on a tour of the Dachau concentration camp, and thereafter negotiated with the SS to hire camp inmates as slave labor for his factories and newly acquired coal mines. Among the continuing sources of that labor were the 2 million innocent men and women arrested by the SS in dragnets across Europe. The Germans had introduced slavery into Europe, and Flieck was conveniently unburdened by any obligation to ensure the well-being of those unfortunates. His contract stipulated payment to the SS, not to the workers. To Flieck's embarrassment, one of his own internal documents produced at Nuremberg showed how he had initiated a request to Himmler's minions for more labor to work in his factories. The reason was that his slaves, working and living in murderous conditions, especially in his coal mines, were dying of malnutrition, disease, and beatings, and he required replacements. American investigators discovered documents proving that about 40,000 men and women had perished in the cause of Flieck becoming one of the Third Reich's wealthiest tycoons. During his trial, Flieck was asked by the prosecution to name one German industrialist who was punished for refusing to use slave labor. Nonchalantly, he remained silent. Similarly, Flieck could not identify any German industrialist who was punished for not joining Himmler's group. Contrary to the revisionist fables peddled even now in the current controversy, most of Germany's industrialists, while serving the regime, did not collaborate with the SS or commit crimes. Flieck was among the greedy exceptions. Flieck's incarceration in Lahnsburg prison was comfortable. He was also advised by Germany's preeminent banker Hermann Abs to stall the American court's order confiscating his empire. In 1948, when the old Reichsmark currency was replaced by the Deutsche Mark, revaluing Flieck's solid assets swollen by his wartime plunder and profiteering, Abs negotiated with the government to swap Flieck's exhausted coal mines and factories for Daimler-Benz. A good deal, Abs proudly claimed in 1979, reminiscing about Flieck's fortunate early release at the outbreak of the Korean War and his client's appointment of Nazi cronies to Daimler's new board of management. By the way, Hermann Abs, one of the Third Reich's principal bankers before, during, and after World War II, also the person invited in 1982 by Pope John Paul II to straighten out the Vatican's financial crisis. This last sentence again. A good deal. Let me read the last two sentences. In 1948, when the old Reichsmark currency was replaced by the Deutsche Mark, revaluing Flieck's solid assets swollen by his wartime plunder and profiteering, Abs negotiated with the government to swap Flieck's exhausted coal mines and factories for Daimler-Benz. A good deal, Abs proudly claimed in 1979, reminiscing about Flieck's fortunate early release at the outbreak of the Korean War and his client's appointment of Nazi cronies to Daimler's new board of management. So please note that after the war, Flieck appointed many of his Nazi cronies, as exemplified there, to the Daimler-Benz board of directors. One of the things to understand about not only Germany, but also in particular the functioning of German corporations, is that, and this will seem ridiculous to the uninitiated listener, in fact, the Third Reich did not disappear. But in one of the more remarkable accomplishments in modern history, the Third Reich went underground, maintaining its political, military, and economic chain of command. The Nazis had anticipated their military defeat in World War II early on. In fact, by October of 1941, when the German General Staff realized they were not going to knock the Soviet Union out of the war before the Soviet winter set in, they began making plans for defeat because they knew that they were not going to knock out the Soviet Union, and they knew that Japan was going to attack the United States, bringing them into the war. As we looked at in RFA 37, accessing material from Covert Action Quarterly number 35 in an article by Carl Oglesby entitled The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, even after Nazi spymaster Reinhard Gehlen had gone to work for the CIA, taking with him Hitler's entire Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, Gehlen was still reporting regularly to Karl von Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as the ostensible head of state of Nazi Germany, and General Franz von Halder, Gehlen's chief of staff. Basically, the German military chain of command was still operating, and as we have seen and will see, the political and economic chain of command was still operating as well, with the remarkable Bormann Flight Capital Organization filling those roles. Martin Bormann was Hitler's top aide during the Third Reich and an organizational genius and viewed by many as the single most important figure of the Third Reich. Bormann, contrary to popular mythology, did not die at the end of World War II. We'll touch on that later on in this discussion. But rather, Bormann put together a series of 750 corporations beginning in August of 1944, and using the corporate masking pioneered by IG Farben magnate Hermann Schmitz, much of the liquid wealth of Europe was secreted into these 750 corporations, which were then managed by Bormann and the Nazi Party in exile after Bormann fled to Latin America. Later on, these corporations pumped money back into the German core corporations, and the political integrity of the underground Reich was maintained by General Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, who, along with the SS, maintained a strict Nazi discipline after World War II. Basically, any Nazi who crossed the underground Reich was dealt with by the SS and the Gestapo in the fashion that the SS and Gestapo traditionally dealt with by dissenters. They were simply eliminated. As noted in the miscellaneous archive show The Flight of the Wolf, Heinrich Müller went to work for U.S. intelligence at the end of World War II. He also supposedly died. This came out in the 1980s when accessed by a London Times journalist. There was a complete press blackout on this subject. As noted in the definitive text about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, which we're about to talk about, Heinrich Müller maintained the iron discipline of the Third Reich in the underground period, and while remaining the Third Reich's Minister of the Interior in exile, literally the Minister of Interior in exile, and enforcing Third Reich dictates through the ferocity and deadly discipline that the SS and Gestapo were noted for, Heinrich Müller also worked with Western intelligence. Reinhard Gehlen continued to clear his actions with Heinrich Müller, among others, well into the period, the post-war period, in which he worked for U.S. intelligence, and the CIA also worked with Heinrich Müller's organization, and thereby, by extension, the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization. I am of the opinion that the Bormann organization will prove to be the dominant element in human affairs on this planet, and failing a sea change in human political affairs, I think that the underground Reich, now coming back overground, will prove victorious, an altogether remarkable accomplishment, no less remarkable for how bloody and evil its legacy is likely to be. There are some listeners who have taken issue with my talking about the Bormann organization as being remarkable and deadly. Well, it's both of those things, and I am of the opinion, perhaps wrong, that they will ultimately prevail. I strive in this program to be an accurate analyst. I am not a polemicist or an ideologue, and if there are those people who find those statements troubling, and I would imagine there are, rather than bellyaching at me about making those statements, I would suggest that you get busy and try to alter the political and social realities that I'm talking about, rather than complaining about my analysis. Perhaps my analysis is inaccurate, but I strive for accuracy, and I believe that the Bormann organization and the Third Reich are going to prevail. I hope I'm wrong, but I think I'm right. Eh bien, the definitive text about the Bormann organization is entitled Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning. Manning was part of the CBS News team that covered covered World War II in Europe, along with Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow. Manning was a very capable and brave journalist. At one point, he covered the air raids into Western Europe. And as such, he had to train as a waste gunner for a B-17 because the bombers couldn't carry any extra weight. Any weight that they carried had to be utilized, and so Paul Manning trained as a waste gunner in a B-17 and was actually credited with shooting down an ME-109. He's a remarkable journalist, and in one of the more remarkable journalistic accomplishments of all time, he wrote the definitive text about not only Martin Bormann, the political and organizational genius not only behind Hitler, but behind the Underground Reich, an individual whom I think will prove to be the single most important historical influence in the 20th and probably 21st centuries. But he published that book, again, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart Incorporated, copyright 1981. Some listeners have found that that book is out of print. Others have had some success in contacting Barnes & Noble, primarily through their website. So I would look up the Barnes & Noble website, and there are some listeners who have been able to obtain that book. So Barnes & Noble may still have some of those copies in stock. Again, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. And in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, it discusses the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, essentially formed at the end of the war when the military defeat of the Third Reich was inevitable. The 750 corporations set up by Martin Bormann and investigated by the Allied intelligence operation Operation Safe Haven, interdicted at the end of World War II when the residual elements of the Third Reich hooked up with Western intelligence, and when the residual Nazi elements in Germany were put right back in power because of their anti-communist, anti-labor, and pro-eugenics stance, which endeared them to many powerful interests in the West, particularly during the Cold War. It's important to understand in analyzing the Bormann Flight Capital Organization that those 750 corporations, which continued to be managed right up into the post-war period, to the contemporary period, they are not only a power in and of themselves, but they exist in a fundamental state of capital relationship with the German core corporations, Daimler-Benz, Volkswagen, Siemens, Bertelsmann, and the other corporations. It's important to understand that the political and economic control of corporate Germany is maintained by the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization, again, an element that I think will prove to be the decisive entity in human affairs on this planet. Turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and of the relationship between the German, the major German corporations and the Bormann organization, Manning writes, West Germany's economic power structure is fueled by a two-tier system. The corporations and individuals who publicly represent the products that are common household names around the world, and the secretive groups operating in the background as holding companies, and who pull the threads of power in overseas corporations established during the Bormann tenure in the Third Reich. As explained to me, quote, these threads are like the strands of a spider's web, and no one knows where they lead except the inner circle of the Bormann organization in South America. And, of course, this was written in 1981 when there was still an East and West Germany. More about this two-tiered structure, and again Manning's writing in 1981. As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, Bormann is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power is shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Some still envision a Fourth Reich. This is but the dream talk of aging adventurers who will soon pass from the mortal scene. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of German finance and industry. Quote, all orders come from the shareholders in South America, unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. Returning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, what we're going to look at next is the relationship between the capital that was shifted to the 750 Bormann corporations and the major German core corporations, which then became beneficiaries of some of that capital once the Federal Republic was incorporated. The 750 Bormann corporations have continued to expand on their own, hence the two-tier nature of the Bormann organization on one hand and the inextricably linked German corporate economy on the other. Manning writes, "Money continued to trickle into West German firms from the private investment sector during the late 40s, but not until May 5, 1955, when the Federal Republic of Germany became a sovereign government and the Allied occupation forces had left, did the enormous sums shifted from the Third Reich away from threatened Allied seizure become available to those groups in West Germany that had participated in Martin Bormann's program of flight capital." And skipping down of Bormann, of German, and in particular the IG Farben Chemical Company's purchases in the United States, IG Farben having been broken up into three major companies after World War II, Banning writes, "The United States is, of course, the major market, one into which these German corporations continue to pour investment money for both new capital construction and corporate takeovers. BASF and Hoechst have each invested in excess of $1 billion in such expansions, and Chief Executive Herbert Grunewald of Bayer AG has said that they plan a $1 billion expansion into the United States within 5 to 10 years. So again, when one sees German corporate acquisitions in the United States, one should always bear in mind the two-tier nature of the German economy. It's also why when I read the book Serpent's Walk, I realized that it was had a foundation in fact. Returning once again to the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk by Randolph D. Calverhall, again about a Nazi takeover by the descendants of the SS in the 21st century, we read, and by the way, the characters here are Wrench and Lessing. Lessing, a mercenary, Wrench, one of the Nazi faithful. Wrench decided he had Lessing's attention. Quote, "In 1945, when Germany lost, two submarines arrived in Argentina. Some of the remaining senior officers of the SS were aboard. They brought money, lots of money, a good part of the treasury of the Third Reich. People thought it was lost or stolen down in Bavaria, but it wasn't." "Thanks, I've seen the movie," Lessing scoffed. "Martin Bormann in the Promised Land. It's true, though. You can read the historical stuff later if you want," such as, by the way, I would interject, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Skipping down, "It wasn't only Bormann. There were others." Seeing Lessing's look, Wrench hurried on. "They founded a colony, set up businesses, made connections. Later, they invested, linked up, and developed. They built a series of interlocking corporations. The post-war boom and the recovery of Germany helped those corporations become conglomerates, then huge international holding companies based in the goddamnedest places." And skipping down, "Yes, everything neat and tidy, out of sight, away from the Jews and the Nazi hunters and their network of financial institutions and pressure groups." And skipping down, "They realized that the world was heading toward a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. Some of them are owned now by the old money interests. The Japanese and various foreign cartels run others. The born-agains have a couple. The Jews and their buddies control some big ones, and we, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining." That's one of the reasons why I view this book as far more than the novel it purports to be. It is based on fact. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.